Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Quick note before I get into today's episode, I am going to record my latest Ask Me Anything and discussion episode with Sagar this upcoming week. So if you would like to hear that full episode this weekend or submit your own questions, comments, or just basically anything you're interested in us discussing, be sure to go to realignment.supercast.com or you can click the link at the top of this episode's show notes. On to the actual episode. This is basically TikTok week at The Realignment. We're going to investigate the debate around the Senate bill that could divest TikTok from ByteDance in the United States. I've got a pro and a con episode, so today is going to be the pro episode. I'm joined by my QT Austin colleague, director of the Strauss Center and former chairman of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, Adam Klein. We discuss his case for divesting and why we could still accomplish the task with the national security and civil liberty priorities maintained in both cases. Hope you all enjoy this conversation, and a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. And you're going to notice we mentioned a bunch of studies and reports in this piece, so you could definitely find those linked in the show notes as well. Adam Klein, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to chat with you as a University of Texas colleague, but also as someone who, broadly speaking, has the right mix of perspectives when it comes to national security, how the actual legal aspects of the TikTok debate work, and just the broader focus on privacy. Speaking of which, I think a good way to set up a lot of your context for this episode would just be quickly introducing yourself, mentioning the Strauss Center, and then, of course, your former chairmanship of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board.
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm a professor at the University of Texas, where I teach at the School of Law. My courses cover counterterrorism, national security law, intelligence, government surveillance, and then, of course, the flip side of those issues, which are civil liberties, constitutional rights, the separation of powers, secrecy, and democratic control. I also run something called the Strauss Center for International Security and Law. We study things like intelligence, national security law, the use of force, technology and global affairs, privacy, transnational data transfers, cybersecurity, and these other issues that are coursing around this TikTok debate. You asked about the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, perhaps not the first federal agency that jumps to most people's minds when they think of the federal Leviathan, probably one of the smallest independent agencies in the federal government. It was created as a recommendation of the 9/11 Commission, which some of your older listeners will remember investigated the 9/11 attacks, produced the definitive National Book Award nominated account of the attacks and the authoritative factual description of what happened, and then also made 41 recommendations for preventing a recurrence of those attacks. Many of those recommendations gave greater power to the federal government, greater scale to the intelligence community, helped the intelligence community take data and synthesize it. And so to counterbalance all of these centralizing tendencies, giving greater power to intelligence agencies, the board recommended creating a check, which was this the commission recommended creating an independent executive branch agency to look into what the agencies were doing all this with all this power and information, and to ensure that the balance between civil liberties and privacy and national security was kept within appropriate parameters. And so I was chairman of that board for several years, and we looked at all kinds of interesting programs ranging from big data collection at NSA to Treasury's use of financial transfer data to the Homeland Security Department's use of facial recognition at airports.
So that's actually the perfect place to start, because there are a bunch of pro-TikTok arguments that I have very little sympathy for. But one I have a lot of sympathy for, especially coming from just like a layman, average person, is just this idea of, hey, as a society, we are reckoning with our response to 9/11. A lot of folks, I think, just feel as if we didn't get the right mix of security and freedom and liberty balanced properly. And they are concerned when it comes to addressing this issue of great power competition and China and the US in tech and speech, that we are also in danger of overreaching. How do you respond to that characterization of how the past 20 years went? And to what degree are these two eras related, or is it also just kind of mingling two things together that have nothing to do with each other?
I think it's always healthy to start as Americans with the slightly paranoid, don't trust the government, grab your musket perspective. That view is, and that mentality are deeply baked into our founding orientation, into our Constitution. Anyone who says just trust the government, that is not an American way of doing business. Our starting presumption is that concentrated power should not be trusted. It has to be supervised, has to be checked, and citizens have to have an opportunity to object, complain, and know what their government is doing. So that is a very healthy mindset to start with, and I don't criticize anyone for being skeptical of bans, for being skeptical of surveillance. That's totally fine. I do think that we have to be able to distinguish between good and bad uses of federal power and to look accurately and in a mature way at these things. Not every use of federal power is bad. Not every instance of national security surveillance is overreach. And we also have to remember that our Constitution aims not merely to check power, but also to enable the government to act effectively, to provide for the common defense, to secure the general welfare, to secure the blessings of liberty. You cannot experience the blessings of liberty in anarchy. And I think that's actually the conundrum that we're facing here with TikTok, is that the American people are being asked to accept a restriction on their freedom in order to protect our broader constitutional order, which ultimately enables to enjoy our rights in safety, to enjoy the ordered liberty that our Constitution gives us. There are some very deep constitutional and philosophical waters that we get into with this debate. Now, you asked about the post 9/11 narrative, that it's this 20-year story of overreach. I don't accept that. Certainly, there were some, perhaps many mistakes, both in foreign policy, some excesses in domestic policy. But by and large, given the scale of what happened to us, and given the certainty that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups would have continued to do the same thing if they weren't stopped, we continue to live in freedom here in this country. We continue to enjoy the right to criticize our government. We travel in commercial aviation safely and abundantly at low cost. After 9/11, it was unclear whether urban centers would ever recover because of fears of terrorism, whether commercial aviation would ever recover. We've done it. We continue to exist. We're
commercial aviation is in a kind of weird space right now, but not for 9/11 related issues.
Maybe so. Nobody ever likes the food and nobody likes taking their shoes off. But, you know, my students often complain, why do we have to take our shoes off? Why do we have to do liquids? Isn't this all security theater? It's not. Those things all come from real attacks or real attempted attacks that were either committed or foiled by the federal government. And if we didn't cut off those avenues of attack, terrorists would keep using them. We know they have an enduring fascination with commercial aviation. These threats are not invented. The 3,000 people who were killed on 9/11, tragically, hideously, are evidence of that. This was a very real threat. We certainly made mistakes. There were certainly excesses. There were certainly violations of law that were committed at some points, but that is not the bulk of the story. The bulk of the story ultimately has to be that we didn't have a series of mass casualty attacks on the scale of 9/11. And the people in the government who were responsible for protecting us, from the military, intelligence services, and all the way down the line, do deserve a great deal of credit for that.
I want to interrogate something you said there, because it gets to the core of this debate. Folks will hear this on Thursday's upcoming episode, where I debate Taylor Lorenz a bit on this topic. You pointed out and referenced limiting Americans' freedoms when it came to TikTok, like that juxtaposition. And I guess I'd really want to push on that, because, and I know this isn't quite your position, but in the 70s, right? Everyone loves using the example of back during the Cold War, we wouldn't let the Soviets or a foreign adversary purchase an American telecommunications company. Rupert Murdoch famously had to give up his Australian citizenship in order to actually acquire American media companies because of those laws. When folks say that limiting the CCP's ability to own telecommunications assets in this country, I kind of say, we don't say, wow, we were so limited in our freedom when it came to not having Rupert Murdoch buying things in the 60s or early 70s before he gave up his citizenship. We didn't say to ourselves, oh, hey, think of all the great Soviet-based telecoms and maybe like Soviet programs that could have happened if the Soviets were able to own telecommunications infrastructure. So I just kind of, I'd be curious how you think about this. I just kind of reject the idea that there's inherently a freedom trade-off when it comes to foreign adversaries and their inability to own specific critical infrastructure. I'm curious how you think about that.
Yeah, and look, obviously, you know, and presumably by this point, the listeners know which side of this debate that I'm on, that I favor the divestiture bill. But I do think it's incumbent on us to give the opposing view its fullest and fairest articulation. Some people might well say, I want to use an algorithm that is designed in China. I want to use an algorithm designed by the Chinese Communist Party. And this bill would say, effectively, that you can't, that you have to use an algorithm to sort your content, deliver your content that is owned by not necessarily an American company, but at least a non-Chinese, Russian, Iranian, or North Korean company. That is, to some degree, an infringement on your freedom of choice as a user. And so we don't need to dismiss that altogether. Many people are perfectly content with TikTok and its current ownership structure. And so to some extent, it is an intrusion by the federal government on how the market and user choice would resolve this question in the absence of federal intervention. So we have to take that seriously, to accept that there's a degree of coercive action by the state here. People are entitled to object to that. Americans are entitled to say, I'd prefer to choose freely among the available options. And so I'm happy to get into why I don't think there's a constitutional problem with doing that. You alluded to some of the reasons, but I do think we have to take it seriously and say that, yes, there's an act of government use of coercive power here, and that we have to take that seriously and question it skeptically.
Okay. And this is another reason why I actually appreciate speaking to someone with a serious legal background on this issue. The reason why I was frustrated in asking you that question is I've yet to encounter many anti-TikTok divestiture folks who bemoan the ownership rules that prevented Rupert Murdoch from buying anything until he became a citizen. And also, very few, if any, people have said, yeah, it was unjust for the US to not allow the Soviet Union to buy telecommunications assets back in the 70s. So those seem to be settled questions today. To what degree were those at the time controversial 50-50 legal questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd want to do more research before answering that. I think we have to just step back to first principles here for a second and say whose rights are at issue and what rights are we talking about? Are we talking about the rights to own platforms? Are we talking about the rights to perform an editorial function? Are we talking about the right to view specific types of content? Those are very different questions. And if you're an American citizen, your First Amendment rights are paramount. If you're a foreign power, your First Amendment rights are much lower. So I sometimes think we race into the discussion of these legal questions without actually dissecting which question are we answering? Mm-hmm. Whose rights are we talking about? Which rights are we talking about? Is it the platform? Is it the broadcaster? Is it the individual? Now, as you said, the FCC has long, we're talking more than 50 years here, had rules governing foreign ownership that are mandated by statute. The rule is that foreign powers cannot own, or foreign entities cannot own, broadcast media here in the United States. Now, of course, there are foreign media in the United States on cable, for example. So it's not as if we live in a zone that's free of foreign voices. Nor should we. We want to have a diversity of views. The question is who owns the channels on which those views are aired. And our government has long taken the position through Congress, through the people's representatives by statute, that it is problematic to have foreign powers controlling the channels and the ability to dictate what kind of information is passed through to the American people. That's not to say that foreign powers' views are not present in our information space. We want to have a diverse information space. I don't want the US government saying which views can be present, but that's different than who controls the channels by which those views make it to us. Now, the case of broadcast is interesting because broadcast media is given special regulatory attention because broadcast frequencies are scarce in a way that cable or internet is not. So you can have 10 million internet sites. You can't have 10 million broadcast TV stations. So for that reason, our government has long felt we should pay special attention to who controls these broadcast airwaves. Now, you might say TikTok's just another website, so that argument for scarcity doesn't apply. The problem is with the network effects of social media. Mm. We've seen that you can only have so many dominant social media platforms because the value of a network squares with the number of users. It's a natural oligopoly, if not if not monopoly? Would we allow internet search to be controlled by a foreign power? Many of us don't think it's healthy for internet search to be controlled by a single dominant American company. And so we really are getting into the question of should we and can we allow a hostile foreign power to control what Americans see and hear? And I'm happy to talk about the evidence, which I think is quite compelling, that TikTok actually already does that, because it is quite alarming when you see the facts about how information is portrayed on TikTok.
One quick thing before we get into the evidence here. This is the realignment. We spent a lot of time focusing on how policymakers misjudged or made certain mistakes in the 90s and 2000s especially. But my takeaway whenever I hear you articulating this broadcast dynamic and the monopoly dynamic or the oligopoly dynamic is that clearly policymakers during the early internet underestimated the ways that even though the internet and the digital space are truly different than what came before in an analog manner, some of the same questions raised by that period are just as relevant. So for example, if you actually notice, you know, I was a little uncharitable when I said, I don't know a single person on the anti-divestiture side who says that they oppose the cable ownership rules from the 70s. What they will often say is, yeah, I don't oppose those rules because at a core level, the internet is a different space. The internet is different. To your point, there's user-generated content. It's not as if, you know, CBS wasn't posting people's videos. So to what degree do you think there is truly a difference between the world of the 90s and the world of the 70s when it came to digital versus analog, legally speaking? Like, does it legally matter?
Sure. If you're existing in a pure world of user-generated content, where there is no algorithm, where you're simply seeing a timeline of posts by people you've chosen to follow with no recommendation engine, no thumb on the scales by the platform, it may not actually make a difference. But that's not the world we're living in. And now we're getting into Section 230 land and the question of whether these platforms are publishers in a constitutional sense or as a practical matter. If you have a recommendation algorithm that is serving most or all of the content to the user, you are very much in control. The idea that it's user-generated content is true, but only in a very, very limited sense, because the overall broadcast, if you want to call it that, or the overall story is assembled by the editor, which is the algorithm. So the person who controls the algorithm is the one who is actually producing the content, even if it's stitched together from a pastiche of things that users have uploaded.
That's helpful. And one other question before we get into the evidence. In national security context, to what degree do our kind of colloquial notions of burden of proof and evidence like actually matter? The reason why I'm asking this question is, let's say it's the year 1913. Obviously, there are undersea telegraph cables between the United Kingdom and the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. United Kingdom and France, possible allies in a conflict with Germany. If I'm sitting in Parliament, I don't think it particularly matters that I prove it's a national security vulnerability to have a German conglomerate own the UK's telecommunications infrastructure. It's just a bad idea. And I don't have to prove that anyone's doing anything wrong. It's just that, hey, if we are in a dreadnought shipbuilding contest with this country premised on a possible war, we just shouldn't do that. So that's why I get a little worried when we talk about evidence. Because when usually I've noticed in these TikTok debates, the folks who are focused on evidence and burden of proof tend to be non-national security related folks who are bringing those concepts from a domestic context into one that we would never do when it came to national security. So I'm curious what you think about that.
Sure. I absolutely agree. For me, the most powerful argument is not the past evidence, which we will talk about in a second, and I think is quite compelling. It's the future risk. You do not allow someone else to put his or her hand on your throat because they haven't previously strangled someone. It's simply not a good position to find yourself in. It constricts your freedom of action. It places you in danger. Why would we allow our most dangerous adversary to have a direct access to the minds and morale of hundreds of millions of Americans when our military leaders have told us there's a chance that we will be at war with them this decade? If we are in a war with China over Taiwan, that is an existential matter for both sides. Do we think that they're going to forbear from using this incredible propaganda tool and angle of attack on our national morale, if they're in an existential fight with everything at stake, of course they'll use it. I'd use it. They'd be stupid not to. So what would they do? Would they send videos to young Americans of people panicking about the risk of being drafted and encouraging them to go to anti-war protests? Would they send demoralizing messages to reservists who are being called up? We know that they have ample data to figure out who's in the U.S. military, who's a reservist, who's a National Guardsman, and so forth. There's no limit to the number of potential permutations that they could come up with for ways to use this propaganda tool in very subtle, very hard to detect ways to erode our morale. We cannot give them that access to our society. It's too dangerous. And by the way, they don't let American social platforms operate there. Why not? What do they know about the potential of these platforms that we don't? And we haven't even gotten into data harvesting and how they can use this thing in peacetime for propaganda purposes and influence purposes.
And a key thing, because I want to be very precise with this language, this isn't even about proving specifically that there is a CCP minder sitting in ByteDance office who's going to personally send, because I think that we need to be very careful of our language here, personally decide that this specific video is actually going to be sent to Americans and demoralize and do this, this, or that. It's the fact that the actual algorithm, to your actual point, clearly, and look, this is why I want to be very precise about the Israel-Palestine stuff, because I think a few times too many pro-Israel people have been a little too focused on the exact nature of the pro-Palestine content and making it seem as if like their issue is that inherently there's an American sitting in their like suburb who's producing like an anti-Israel video. When I think the actual issue that matters there is clearly the TikTok algorithm preferenced that style of content over other styles of content. So for me, it's less the specific content itself and more just that like, and look, I spend time on YouTube. I'll tell you something, whenever I do any, and this isn't even just like, you know, a Chinese social media company, doomer content, negative content, that just tends to do well on social media algorithms. So from a national security perspective, I just want to make clear, my case is not if TikTok proves there isn't a CCP minder sitting, pushing the button on which video goes viral. It's actually just the reality of how this platform operates that becomes tremendously perilous for us.
Yeah. First of all, the CCP has golden shares in TikTok, which give it a degree of control that other investors, board members do not have. So there are formal mechanisms of control. The Senate has shown that there are CCP members throughout TikTok, ByteDance's engineering team in Beijing. The engineering team has access to the user data, has access to the algorithm and the platform. So the idea that there are these firewalls and that they're completely innocent, nothing has ever been shown, is just not true. But even more than that, in China, the party is superior to the state. It is a party state, as any expert on Chinese politics will tell you. The will of the party prevails. There is not the rule of law. There is the rule by law. And if the party decides that a private company needs to do something to support the party will make them do it. Jack Ma, one of China's most shimmering tech founders, made an offhand comment about the Chinese government and was sent to break rocks for something like a year, completely disappeared and came back a completely chastened and shaken man. They know, Chinese tech founders know, that you heed the will of the party or else. We cannot imagine that there is any insulation between a company and the needs of the party. If China's in a conflict with the United States, ByteDance will do exactly what it's told, exactly what the CCP thinks is in China's best interest.
So speak to the evidence question then. What's the evidence of past act?
Let's talk about some of the evidence. So for me, there's two categories of threat here. One is the algorithm and the influence vector. The other one is data harvesting. Why don't we start with the influence vector? Because in some ways it's more dramatic and it's kind of what we're talking about here. There was a great study by a center at Rutgers University. And I can share the link and you can post it in the show notes for the listeners if helpful, that looked at the ratios of particular types of content on Instagram and versus TikTok, assuming that the demographics of the user bases are roughly similar. Okay, maybe it's not perfect, but you'd expect these things to be roughly in proportion to one another. Many of the same content creators post on both, etc. And so they found that for pop culture topics, there was a general 2x ratio of posts on Instagram to the number of posts on TikTok. Politics, in generally, without a specific filter, politics generally was 2.6 times. Okay, so we have a sense. These is kind of in bounds. These are sort of comparable. Then they looked at specific types of content, specific hashtags related to Chinese Communist Party sensitivities. So for the Uyghurs, it was 11x. So that's 5 times greater disparity. On Tibet, it was 37x, 37 times more activity on Instagram than on TikTok on that topic. Starting to get a little suspicious. Hong Kong, 85x. Hong Kong, 181x. So 181 times more posts on using pro-Hong Kong hashtags on Instagram than on TikTok. This is well beyond the realm of coincidence. Tiananmen Square, 8.5x. Ukraine, 85x for Tiananmen and 8.5x for Ukraine. So 8.5 times more for pro-Ukraine hashtags. On Kashmir, so they looked
anti-Ukraine hashtags.
No, pro-Ukraine hashtags were 8 times more common on Instagram than on TikTok.
Oh, okay, got it.
Sorry, I know I'm doing a terrible job. This is why I'm a law professor, not a math professor. And on Kashmir, so pro-Kashmir posts, which you can read as anti-India posts, so freedom for Kashmir, etc., 600 times more on Instagram, on TikTok than on Instagram. So, of course, India and China have a geopolitical rivalry. 600 times more of this anti-India set of hashtags on TikTok than on Instagram. Is that naturally occurring? And we see that India has gotten the message. They see what's going on here and they've banned TikTok. And Indian users have shifted to other apps. This is not the work of a naturally occurring coincidence. These are not the kind of numbers that happen in nature in a vacuum. It's extremely suspicious. We see what they're doing here. The exact mechanism is opaque, but at some point, as with Newton, if the apple falls from the tree downward every time, you can infer that there's some kind of invisible force propelling it there.
I think the thing that's really fascinating there is what's the benign possible explanation? Because you know what I love about the way you set this up? And this is why I think it was a strategic and tactical mistake. I understand why there are a lot of representatives and like constituencies that were very activated by the disparity between pro-Israel and pro-Palestine posts. But obviously, like we work at a college campus, it's like not a shocker, but there's like in American society, age gap differences in opinion on Israel and Palestine. That seems pretty natural to me. But in all the topics you just discussed, most of them do not have serious American constituencies. So there is not a Zoomers are obsessed with Kashmir, yeah. Right? There's no logical reason for that organic disparity in those topics, separate from the Middle East, where the United States obviously has a complicated relationship with the region.
Yes, I left out Israel for that reason. They did show a disparity there. It wasn't as drastic as Hong Kong or Tiananmen. For that reason, you might be able to explain that one away as generational differences on this topic. So that to me, that's not even the strongest evidence. Hong Kong, 181 times. Is there a reason why a 14-year-old American would feel much less supportive of Hong Kong's freedom than a 35-year-old American? That doesn't seem obvious to me at all. There's no particular reason to have such a drastic breakdown on these topics that could be explained by demographics. But you asked, what is the possible benign explanation? I don't know, but TikTok has not provided it. They're best positioned to give the benign explanation for these numbers, and they haven't done so. Quite the contrary. After this Rutgers study came out, and I really encourage people to look at this study. Hopefully you can distribute the link. After the study came out, TikTok killed the hashtag search feature that had enabled them to do the study. In the law, we have something called an adverse inference. If you destroy evidence, the judge will instruct the jury to draw an adverse interest, that is a negative inference against you about what was in the evidence. Because we can presume that if you destroyed it, it wasn't good for you. Why did they take down the hashtag comparison feature?
Question I'd ask for you here, because we're about to get into the second bucket, which is the privacy bucket. I want to be very wary when it comes to talking about the data privacy issues, because clearly this is a political fight. This is a political battle. There are a lot of whataboutist tactics that are used by the anti-divestiture folks instead of people. When we start talking about data privacy, we very quickly get into, but everyone has data privacy threats or violations. And therefore, what we need to do is pass a data privacy bill that address all of these issues, which, funnily enough, if you know anything about the legislative actual issues here, there is zero chance that on any reasonable timeline, the best constructed data privacy law would ever pass in the first place. So clearly, if you're weaponizing that argument, why don't we do this other thing? We could have run, basically, there's been a debate over banning TikTok, divesting TikTok, depending on your, you know, use of the colloquialisms there, for over 4 years. We've had 4 years to come up with this alternative policy. If you can't actually build a coalition there, I don't think that's a sustainable thing. So just talk to me why you still think it's useful to focus on the data privacy side, because I just tend to rhetorically ignore it, because I actually see it as being a tactic used by people who are trying to delay any action and just get everyone mad about Mark Zuckerberg.
Look, I get it. If you are like us and you sit around thinking all day about national security, national defense, you think all day about China, because China is the biggest, most formidable, most impressive. You and I study their military buildup and the capabilities they're developing just to smash U.S. forces in the Western Pacific. So we are obsessed with this topic. And I think rightly, it is the big, most important topic in U.S. national security. If you're just an average person, or if you're just someone who thinks about technology without this security specific lens, you just see a bunch of big tech companies and they're all harvesting data and they're all doing this and they're all doing that. And they're all terrible for privacy. And it all just looks like an undifferentiated privacy mess if you're not picking that specific China factor out of the haystack the way you and I are and focusing on it. So I get it. I understand it. We should deal with those privacy violations by those companies. The key fact is Congress can deal with Meta, with Google, with Microsoft, with LinkedIn, with X, to the extent that those companies have privacy problems, because they have U.S. owners who have to listen to Congress and the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. They have to care because this is their corporate home base. They can be held accountable. So sure, Congress hasn't done enough to rein in their privacy violations. We all agree on that. But there's at least the hope that we can do that and get answers, because they have to come in and give a straight answer. They ultimately answer to Uncle Sam. ByteDance does not. We will never get a straight answer out of them. We saw that with the hearings when the TikTok CEO came in. They cannot give and will not give a straight answer to the United States, because their first loyalty is to China. That's their home base. That's who they answer to. So if your response to all of this is we need to regulate big tech and stop privacy violations, fine, I agree with you. But you can't do that unless they are domiciled here, or at least in a friendly country. That is a prerequisite for having meaningful privacy control of a company, is having it domiciled in a place where you can influence it. That will never happen as long as this company is domiciled in your chief geopolitical adversary.
Fascinating counter of what I heard from anti-divestiture folks is just, do you not trust that Apple would enforce privacy laws in the App Store? Do you know what I mean? So you're saying we can't trust a China-centric ByteDance to follow privacy laws. And there are actually a bunch of people, even on the like anti-divestiture side, who would agree with that. They would say, that's why it matters that Apple has a regulated app store. And if we could prove, let's say we passed, I'm not sure what I believe on this topic, but let's say we did pass legislation that affected all of it. Do you not trust that Apple would enforce those privacy requirements in the Apple store, or that Google would enforce the same thing in the Google store?
Number one, it's a non sequitur, because Apple is not going to be monitoring the TikTok algorithm, the recommendation algorithm, even under the most ambitious privacy laws that people are talking about here. That's still going to be controlled by TikTok. Apple doesn't see it. Apple has nothing to do with it. Those recommendations are generated in the cloud by TikTok, and then the videos are served to your phone. So having Apple as a gatekeeper does nothing for that. Second of all, TikTok will still be able, ByteDance will still be able to sign software updates to your phone. So if we're in a conflict situation, or a tense geopolitical situation. And ByteDance decides to write a new software update that contains some additional kind of spyware feature or some other troubling data harvesting feature, Apple's not going to be in a position to verify every line of code in the software updates that ByteDance is signing off on. Apple can confirm that the authorized company is signing off on that update, that it's coming from a real place, but they're not going to know every new capability that's in there necessarily. And we know this because, you know, even despite Apple's best efforts, and by all accounts, they're the best in the business, bad software still gets into the App Store.
This is actually the vector that I'm most obsessed with, because the ideological coalitions on this topic are like really fascinating. So if you actually really think about another response to beyond the one you offered that I just described when it came to how we should regulate telecom in this country, there are a lot of like people left of center left, Tim Wu, Zephyr Teachout, et cetera, who would basically say, Marshall, you're proposing that the way the United States enact its national security is via outsourcing it to a company. It's basically this very, very neoliberal view that, hey, like, it's actually entirely safe and logical from a political economy perspective to say, hey, we're just going to have Apple regulate whether or not ByteDance is actually following the laws and acting things properly, rather than having the actual state adjudicate the decision through the actually where's your company based issue. And also at a deeper level too, like, I think the other response to the like, why can't we trust that Apple's enforcing these things? Apple is inextricably tied into China. Apple has its own relationship with China when it comes to manufacturing those very iPhones we're downloading the app on. So this, just at a basic core level, comes down to, when it comes to national security, we should not be comfortable with a situation where we're saying, hey, not only are we outsourcing this to the actual market, but it's actually a market actor that's inextricably tied into the geopolitics of a foreign adversary state. So it's just a really fascinating way of understanding these weird confluences of ideology. Once again, that's the idea behind the realignment here. But there's an interesting like coalition in favor of the kind of ideas that you're talking about here.
Absolutely. We haven't even talked about perhaps the biggest misconception in the public debate, which is that we're not even talking about getting rid of it. We're just talking about swapping in a new non-hostile ownership structure. Why are people so opposed to that? And there are two answers to that. One is that they think that there's some kind of fundamental interest or value in having the CCP own this versus having Americans own it. And the second is that they don't actually think the CCP will sell and that it will be banned. The first one just doesn't make any sense. I don't think that people really believe that. I think it comes down to the second, which is people think.
Can I push on that real quick? I will say, as a pro divestiture person, I've been a little wary of the Steven Mnuchin. I'm a former political official. I'm putting together, but it just reeks a little too clearly of crony capitalism and state favor. So I actually do understand how that would make people feel uncomfortable. I think that is actually felt in good faith. Like, there was a really interesting, like, negative organic reaction to the Steven Mnuchin news.
Fair enough, but I have no reason to believe that group is actually the leading contender as opposed to any other group. We know that Walmart was in the mix, Oracle was in the mix. It's possible that a European consortium would want to buy it. The bill doesn't require that it go to an American. It simply says you can't be from China, Russia, Iran, or North Korea. So we actually have no idea who would buy this thing, other than I think we can say with great confidence that the Justice Department would not allow it to be sold to an existing member of the oligopoly. So we will have a new competitor that is not from a hostile power to continue disrupting the existing social media oligopoly, which is probably a healthy thing for competition.
Fair. So to the second, you wanted to focus on like the second argument in terms of like where you're interested.
If you think that they're not going to sell and that they are just going to immolate hundreds of billions of dollars of shareholder value in the form of this incredibly popular viral app, what does that tell you about the decision-making structure for this company? It tells you that the decision-making structure is political rather than economic, which is what we've been saying all along, that this company ultimately answers to political actors in China who are irremediably opposed to the United States and who want to take us down a peg, to push us out of the Western Pacific and to sow chaos and disruption in our country because they see us as opposed to their rise.
I think what's fascinating there too is that I'm trying to steelman the this is politics, not economics. And I started saying to myself, well, look, if you know, if you're China, you don't want to have a divestiture precedent, right? Because for the past 20 years, up until kind of Grindr and CFIUS in like 2019, you had a scenario where China had access to our markets when it came to the digital space. We didn't have access to theirs. But I would say if I'm in the CCP, I would want to say, look, like we're drawing a line in the sand. We have other apps that could hypothetically be affected by this divestiture app. We would send a clear message that we're not going to go along with this actual process. But even that is a political argument. To your point, that's not a market argument. That's actually a peer. If anything, it's actually a trade argument. Because I actually think the best place to start when it comes to, and actually I found this to be the most effective, when I explain this context to just like civilians in the space, this actually resonates the most. Look, at a basic level, this isn't about digital fentanyl. This isn't about she sending a specific video to your kid. It's not about 30-second videos rotting our brains. It's actually the fact that we have an imbalanced trade relationship with China that was premised on a world that no longer exists. This entire trading relationship was premised on, yes, okay, Yahoo, Google, Facebook won't be allowed in the short term. That's definitely a ding. Mark Zuckerberg would definitely like to be let in. It's like not great for his balance sheet. But long term, we are confident that the market orientation will bring in new ideas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone knows the kind of like end of history cliches, but like it's not just a cliche. It's like the entire like way we made the calculus on the trade relationship. Now that no one thinks China is moving in a liberal governmental or market orientation, this trade relationship doesn't make any sense. We would not, if we knew what we knew today, even your most Cato Institute person would not say, good to go. They can't come. We can't come in. They could come in here. So I think just focusing on the trade aspect is very revelatory of the political point you just made a second ago.
Yeah. You can't have one side playing mercantilism and another side playing laissez-faire. It doesn't work. Both sides have to play laissez-faire. We now see that they're not doing that. And in other areas of the economy, we are adjusting. We are putting in place appropriate controls to structure our trade relations with China in a more responsible and equitable way, while preserving free movement of goods, free movement of capital with other partners who do want to trade fair and play fair, which seems to me to be the right approach. In this area, we are held up, understandably, by concerns about speech and messaging. I do think there are a couple more things to emphasize here when we talk about this free speech, freedom of ideas concept. First of all, just because we're saying that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't get to own the channels of communication doesn't mean that we're pushing their messages out. People still have a First Amendment right to hear, think, and frankly, repeat ideas that are propounded by the Chinese Communist Party in the United States. This is not a ban on CCP content. It's not a ban on CCP thoughts or ideas. It's a ban on their owning the channels of communications, that those channels can be shifted into non-hostile control. So that's number one. Americans can still continue to share any videos that they want, to watch any videos that they want. There's no censorship power in this bill at all. I'm one of those people. I'm a First Amendment absolutist. I do not want government censorship. I do not want government jawboning of social media. I do not want U.S. social media companies to be too close to our government or our intelligence community or our law enforcement. This bill does not give any of that power. People can say whatever they want, whether or not it's pro-China, anti-China, Ukraine, Israel, Tiananmen, Hong Kong. This bill does not weigh in on any of those issues. It's all about who controls the channels. As long as it's not a hostile foreign power, people can say, continue to say and do whatever they want on these social media platforms.
Can I pause you there? Because this is where, great, and you're talking about under this bill specifically, but I would like to, it's not a contradiction, but it's kind of a couple of steps down the line tension point. So for example, to your point, you and I hope no one takes away from this episode, Adam and Marshall are freaking out that China Global Times is saying, is like putting out like 30-second videos of anti-American propaganda. That said though, so much of our real focus on this issue is about us taking very seriously the claims that there could be a hot conflict in 2020. As people are saying, we're focusing a little too aggressively on the 2027. Now, the point is, both governments are premising their foreign and defense policies on the idea that there could be a hot conflict within this current decade. Therefore, we need to take the national security side seriously. I would say, though, if we're going to have that conversation, how far does China global times go when it comes to their ability to say what they want in that context? Because key thing, obviously, like, you have Tokyo Rose during World War II, like, you know, this is coming from Tokyo Rose is a collaborator who's saying, like, horrible, like, anti-American, demotivational speeches and thoughts and songs into service members who are traveling on the troop ships deeper into the Pacific, closer to Japan. But once again, like, that's a purely military context. There's no problem just saying any soldier, marine, airman, sailor caught with a radio turned to that thing, like, you're getting non-judicial punished, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's straightforward. But what would it look like in a world where there was an internet and Tokyo Rose is actually able to broadcast directly into the United States? Clearly, in that context, separate from this TikTok debate, we would probably not say we were fine with that. So how do you think about that in this? So, like, let me set it up better. What if China Global Times is posting those anti-American videos, a video of an American sailor? Because I was trying to be precise when I came up with this example, because, for example, Facebook, like, Meta doesn't allow violence. So it's not that Meta would have video of an aircraft carrier sinking and people drowning. Like, that'd be very easy to, like, ban and not allow on the platform. What you would see, though, get posted is a video of a sailor who's, like, drowning, recording a video saying, why did my government allow this to happen? This is a disaster. This isn't worth it. Don't let your kid have this happen to you. Would we allow that to be posted? Like, how do you think about, like, that dilemma? Because that's what I really worry about.
Well, so you've picked a very special case there, which is a member of the military. The constitutional rights of members of the military during service are different than for an ordinary civilian. So that's not exactly okay. The best example. I do want to step back into some of the issues you were talking about. One of my objections to the disinformation framing that we often hear in conversations about this is that it blends two things that need to be kept really separate. Mm. And those are what foreign powers are allowed to do and the opinions that Americans are allowed to have about foreign powers, about foreign policy. An American has every right to say, I think Putin is great. I think Xi Jinping is great. I think the United States should be a communist dictatorship, just like China. I think Russia has every right to invade neighboring countries and reestablish the Soviet Empire. I don't agree with those opinions, but those are constitutionally protected speech. And here's the critical point. Even if they align with foreign narratives, they are still constitutionally protected speech. That is absolutely critical. And my concern is that the disinformation narrative fosters linguistic slippage so that that constitutionally protected speech gets bundled into the disinformation category and is then teed up for censorship. Now, that all being said, foreign powers do not have those same constitutional First Amendment rights. They are not allowed to own channels of communication in our country if Congress prohibits them from doing so. They are not allowed to engage in clandestine propaganda activities. So we have a prohibition on espionage and foreign clandestine intelligence activities. We have the Foreign Agents Registration Act, so that if you are representing for money a foreign government or a foreign entity, you have to register with the U.S. government. You can still speak, you can still have your message, but you have to declare who you're broadcasting that message on behalf of. Foreign powers do not have the same constitutional rights. And so that is what this bill is targeting. This bill is not targeting anyone's right to broadcast messages, to like videos that align with Russian narratives, with CCP narratives. I will be the first one to say that is constitutionally protected speech that our Americans are entitled to engage in. And sometimes it can even be valuable political expression. So just to give an example that I like to use, Abraham Lincoln famously got up during the debate about the Mexican-American War and denounced the administration, denounced the war as an American imperialist endeavor that was based on false pretenses. Now, today, we might call that pro-Mexican disinformation, but that was patriotic dissent as he saw it. Similarly, Barack Obama in 2003 got up, denounced the Iraq War, said that the administration was wrong in its claims about weapons of mass destruction. that was, you know, that could be denounced by using today's framing as pro-Iraqi disinformation. It turned out that what he said was right. We can't be censoring Americans' dissent within their constitutional First Amendment rights about important issues of foreign policy. But we also have to recognize that that is separate from allowing foreign powers to sneak around and engage clandestinely in manipulating those debates. The question is who's doing the speaking, not what the message is or whose narrative it aligns with.
You know, that's a really good articulation of the need for that distinction. Very well taken. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. I would say, though, anyone who has a passing knowledge of the World War I period especially, so this is separate from just sort of like McCarthyism and kind of the colloquial way we talk about that issue. Clearly, your statements about dissent and constitutionality very clearly did not apply during World War I. Given your legal context, why are you confident that we're not in danger of repeat? If you could just explain what I'm really talking about here. Yeah, why are you confident we wouldn't see a repeat of that period?
I'm looking back because there's a book on my shelf, which if I could hold it up, you'd see it was full of little post-it notes called American Midnight by Adam Hochschild.
Adam, which I read that last year. It's a great, quick thing. And I want to praise him. He's a little too old to do a podcast, but it's hard in today's era to do a serious critique of U.S. foreign policy and not and domestic politics and not kind of just like resort to kind of tropiness. It was such a good, it's really a book that I recommend for someone who I think holds our perspectives in a way that doesn't just feel like arbitrary. Such a great book. So please go on.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for those who haven't read the book, it's an examination of the period from really the beginning of World War I through the early 1920s, which he argues quite persuasively was the low ebb of civil liberties in the United States. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, the civil liberties violations that were conducted against people who were against the war, racial attacks, mob violence, lynching, and so forth. So highly recommend it. You asked, am I confident that that can't happen or that this the proximity of government to social media platforms won't be misused? No, I'm not confident at all. I think we've seen a lot of evidence that it can be misused. There's a lot of familiarity between people in government and people in the higher echelons of social media platforms. And so it's all, and they share many of the same technocratic presumptions about which messages are good, which messages are disruptive or destructive, what's disinformation, what's misinformation, and conversely, which edgy narratives are completely fine and which falsehoods are completely fine and in fact must be affirmed. And so it's all too easy to pick up the phone and say, hey, can you help me out? And so I'm not confident at all. The centralized market structure of these platform intermediaries makes that concern all the more pressing because they have such dramatic control over the channels of speech. So no, I'm not sanguine about that at all. And I think it's absolutely right for legislators and citizens to be concerned about that and doing something about it. I come back to the point that we only have a hope of doing something about it because these companies are subject to our laws. It is ultimately political and legal mechanisms that people hope to use it to bring these platform intermediaries to heel. Witness the Supreme Court case that was just argued about jawboning between government officials and social media platforms. Why are you able to go to the courts in the hopes of having a meaningful remedy?
Because what's that jawboning?
It's calling up the company and telling them, hey, you've got disinformation on your platform. You might want to do something about this. By the way, your antitrust, you know, cases percolating in the Justice Department, just mentioning that, no connection whatsoever, of course. It's this idea that you call someone up, you're not explicitly telling them to censor, but you're reminding them that this problematic with air quotes message is on your platform and you may just want to do something about that. Or maybe not, it's your choice. And so people are going to taking this matter to the Supreme Court because they know that the companies will have to obey a judicial order. That's not the case for a platform that is domiciled in Beijing. It answers to Beijing. And so you have no hope of interrupting that process of soft censorship.
So here's how we'll close the episode. Two questions. So first question, we'll do one at a time. So first question, as I said earlier, it seems that our understanding of the differences between a cable television network or a newspaper or a radio station and what an actual social media app are. There's a gap in understanding the differences between the two. And then also there's a gap in understanding the ways with which our relationship with China has changed from the time when many of these laws and actual trade policies were put in place. So just setting us up for April 1st, 2024, the day we're recording this, what is your understanding of what the status quo is between between our relationship with China, what an app is, just like really just give people like a quick summation for how they should root themselves in the present and not outmoded visions of the past.
What is this not about? It's not about videos. You can watch whatever videos you want. The thing that really matters here is, number one, the algorithm. The formula that is used to choose which videos to serve to you and who controls that. That is absolutely critical. There is an infinite, at this point, quasi-infinite range of possible videos that could be served to anyone. And someone is deciding what to show you and in what order and with what frequency and what not to show you. And as we saw with the Hong Kong content, 181 times more on Instagram, which is American-owned, than on TikTok, which is Chinese-owned, somebody is messing with the formula. And they are not doing it because they love the United States. Number two, what power does this give you? I think legislators understand it pretty well. I'd point you to what happened, and this is covered in my piece that hopefully you'll put in the show notes, what happened after Congress passed the bill out of the Energy and Commerce Committee by a 50-0 vote. TikTok started serving its young user base with messages, alarmist messages, that TikTok was going to be banned. The bill is not a ban bill, it's a divestiture bill, but let's move on.
They started disinformation.
I don't use that term. They started serving their young user base with these messages. And what happened? Children as young as 11 started calling the Congress in a panic, calling their member of Congress. Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy from Illinois, the ranking Democrat on the House China Select Committee, said some of them didn't even know what Congress was or why they were calling. But they were calling in a panic, an absolute panic, an absolute tizzy. And you could say, okay, there's a benign explanation. They love this app. Okay, but imagine a situation in which the U.S. and China were on the verge of war, or China was blockading Taiwan, and China was trying to deter the United States from taking action to, for example, escort ships into Taiwan. And all of a sudden, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people responding to some kind of messaging they've seen on TikTok start bombarding Congress with calls. This can seriously constrain our freedom of action to defend ourselves. No other country in its right mind is going to allow its most powerful adversary access to the hearts and minds of its people in the shadow of a potential conflict. We have to be prudent. We have to be smart. No one is saying that this app can't exist, but it can't be owned by our most significant enemy.
So let's close here. Can you just do a shout out to the Strauss Center and your focus on national security and law? Because I think the most revelatory part of doing the show research for this and just delving into this topic is that I think we don't really, if you're interested in these like China topics, you're not starting from a point of the law, the Constitution. Really just give a quick shout out for that approach and like the work that you do in that context.
Sure. Thank you. Well, obviously, I think that approach is best because I'm trained as a lawyer and I'm a law professor. So, of course, that's the most useful instrument for understanding national security. No, I mean, I think an interdisciplinary
approach. You do believe that
approach,
to a certain degree, jokes aside.
We are an interdisciplinary university-wide center at the University of Texas at Austin. But you asked me to give a shout out to the law. And I think this is, it's quite evident in this discussion why the law matters. In the United States, all power that is exercised by our federal government ultimately rests on the Constitution, and then subject to that on statutes that are passed by Congress, who are the authorized representatives of the people exercising power granted to them in the Constitution by the people of the United States. And so if you want to constrain an app, the ownership of an app, if you want to constrain the importation or export of semiconductor equipment, these are all legal authorities and legal instruments that it depends on. If you want to conduct surveillance, you have to point to a source of authority, whether in a statute like FISA or in the Constitution, in Article 2, the executive power. Conversely, all of these authorities are constrained by things like individual rights and the separation of powers. And so that's what makes our system great, is that you as an individual citizen can say, you know what, I like this app and I think I have the right to use it. And I think you lack the authority to ban it. And I'm going to go to court and make you care about my interests, about my claim of right. And that's what distinguishes our system from China's, where you as an individual may feel that you have some God-given right to privacy, but the system is not designed to make that claim or that feeling matter.
Great place to end. Adam Klein, thank you for joining me on The Realignment. And folks, there were a bunch of articles and studies that were shouted out, so be sure to find those in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.